Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. As part of our celebration of the magazine's 80th year of publication, we wanted to include the podcast of a story employing some of the characters from the Ellery Queen novels and stories. We settled on a pastiche by Dale C. Andrews, a longtime dedicated Ellery Queen fan who, with fellow fan Kurt Surku, debuted in our Department of First Stories in May of 2007 with the Ellery Queen tale, The Bookcase. Writing alone now, Dale has gone on to produce three more Ellery Queen pastiches published in EQMM. Here he is reading the most recent of them, Four Words, from the September-October 2020 issue of EQMM.
The story opens with two quotations. The first is from Amtrak's 1976 Southwest Limited brochure. Welcome aboard. We hope you will enjoy your trip. To help you become acquainted with our train, we'd like to describe the various kinds of car facilities that we have on the Southwest Limited. One service that is provided for our first-class passengers is the opportunity to enjoy complete privacy and extra comfort through the choice of a roomette, a bedroom, or a bedroom suite. The second quote is a news dispatch. Paula Paris, Hollywood, California, January 11th, 1976. Renowned actress and Trasa Colon executive, the uber-reclusive Joan Fairchild, will make a rare public appearance as a presenter at this year's Golden Globe Awards, where she will likely be arrayed in her famed diamond baubles. Fairchild, who has an aversion to flying, hasn't traveled to the West Coast for decades. Her last screen appearance was in the 1965 box office bust, Gort, after which she retreated to her Long Island estate. She has not been seen in public for over 10 years. The Amtrak attendant looked up from the printout he held in his left hand as the next passengers approached the car. Two men, one old, the other truly ancient, but walking erect. Need to watch them. The older guy could have problems getting around. The attendant smiled and asked the passengers' names as they approached. Queen, the younger of the two replied, Ellery and Richard. The attendant consulted his manifest and crossed off two names. Queen, yes, I have it. You two are in car 0331, bedroom B. We're the last car in the train, so head down the corridor to your left, and your room will be on the other side of the car, past the roomettes. The diner and the lounge car and the other sleepers and coaches are all ahead of you, to your right. Will you need any help with anything? He asked, eyeing the elder of the two. Ellery smiled and shook his head. As Inspector Richard Queen, retired, grumbled and clambered into the car, Ellery glanced back. Behind him, headed down the platform to them, were two women, tall, mid-60s, sisters, twins, followed by a red cap pushing a pile of luggage. Ellery couldn't help it. He found himself speculating. Despite striking similarities, two women were an incongruous match, one dressed in strict business attire, diligently marching down the platform, the other meandering about, swathed in an outrageous silk and lace concoction, with a sable stole draped around her shoulders. Stop analyzing, Ellery admonished himself. He turned away as the inspector pulled himself into the vestibule of the sleeper. Well, Dad, said Ellery, following him into the car, California, here we come. Later, as the train lurched around a bend, another elderly passenger entered the diner and presented his ticket to the head waiter. Yes, sir, so you're in bedroom C, car 0330. First seating, right this way. The elderly man followed the waiter down the aisle, his fingers touching the tables on either side, lightly reassuring his balance. The waiter guided the man to a table where two other passengers were already seated. The waiter turned, smiled, and gestured toward the empty chair across the table. Right here, across from these gents, sir. The elderly man slid into his window chair, exhaled in relief, and then lifted his gaze to the two men facing him. One was older, though still younger than me, he thought. The other was ancient, easily in his late 80s or early 90s. And then, like an ocean wave breaking, it hit him. My God! He reached across the table, right hand extended. Ellery! Richard! Dear Lord in heaven! I don't believe it! Across the table, four eyes widened, also in surprise, as Ellery reached out to clasp the extended hand. As I live and breathe, J.J., what in the name of unexpected literary devices are you doing here? Have we stumbled onto each other's vacations?
No, sad to say, this isn't a pleasure trip for me. I'm off to Los Angeles for a memorial service for my sister.
Catherine, I didn't know. I'm so sorry, Ellery replied. JJ's smile faded.
Sweet Catherine, Kathy, Red, Kay, Irish, the girl of countless names, he sighed. She died last week. It was sudden, and I wasn't there. But I'll be there for the service.
The old man, lost for an instant in his thoughts, shook his head, as if to clear the cobwebs, and then looked again across the table.
And you fellas, Ellery, Richard, you're off to L.A. also?
That's right, Ellery replied. Dad and I will be there for 2 weeks, watching them shoot an episode of the NBC series. I was there back in September, working on one of the earlier episodes, and Dad made it abundantly clear then that it was unacceptable that I'd left him behind, so we're off to remedy that. The inspector exhaled as he nibbled his mustache.
Too old to travel, eh? He groused, jabbing Ellery with an elbow. I guess I'll show you.
JJ's eyebrows raised.
I read about that earlier trip, the murders. It was all over the press, why?
But his question was cut short as a woman approached the table. Recognition sparked at Ellery's eyes. He had seen her before. She was the outrageously dressed one of the twosome that boarded the train just behind them, still draped in all of that silk and sable. The woman cleared her throat and asked if the remaining seat at the table was taken. The three men shook their heads in unison, and she slid into the chair next to JJ. It was Ellery who broke the silence.
Dining cars have to be one of the best places to make new acquaintances, he said, smiling, and extending his hand once again across the table. My name is Ellery, Ellery Queen.
You mean Ellery Queen, the author? The one in that television show?
Guilty on all counts. And this is my father, Richard. Dad and I are off to Los Angeles to watch the filming of an episode. Sitting next to you is an old and dear friend, the man who wrote the foreword to each of my early novels. He's been thrown by happen chance onto the same train as us, Judge J.J. McHugh.
Gingerly, the lady clasped Ellery's hand for the shortest of seconds before extending it in turn to the other men.
I'm Sandy, Sandy Mint.
Ellery was still smiling, but he was also looking around the dining car. Pardon me, but I saw you board the train with your companion just after us. She's not joining you for dinner?
No, Mrs. Dolchak dines on her own. We aren't so much friends as we are associates. Franny is my personal secretary.
Ellery's eyebrows wrinkled for an instant. I wonder, he began, but the inspector, looking down the aisle of the dining car, interjected.
If I'm not mistaken, I believe that waiter approaching our table is about to pose his own question, which I suspect will pertain to the entrees on these menus.
J.J. McHugh was the first to finish dinner. As the other three nursed their coffees and chatted, he stood, nodded graciously toward Sandy Mint, and then glanced at the inspector and Ellery across the table.
I hope to see you gents later tonight in the lounge car. Until then...
J.J. smiled, fumbled in his pocket for his Amtrak ticket, looked around the car, and then tottered down the aisle between the tables. Sandy Mint finished her coffee.
I think I'll head for the lounge car right now.
She smiled and slid away from the table, departing in the opposite direction. The inspector turned to Ellery, an eyebrow raised.
Did you notice those gals when they boarded the train?
The old man asked. As a matter of fact, I did, Ellery replied.
You know what I bet? I bet we just had dinner with Joan Fairchild, the actress. I read that she's supposed to be headed out to Hollywood for some kind of award, and that she hates flying. The other one, what's her name, Franny? She must be her assistant or something.
Ellery smiled.
Could be, Dad. You follow these things much closer than I do.
The inspector tugged at his mustache and then drained his own coffee.
I'm heading back to our room, he said, sliding his chair back.
Wait a minute. I need to settle up here, and then we can both go, Dad.
The inspector snorted.
Confound it, Ellery! Treat me like an adult. I may be old, but I'm perfectly capable of negotiating my own way back to our car.
The inspector pushed himself up defiantly and lurched down the aisle of the dining car, reeling precariously as the train jolted along the tracks. Ellery looked around and signaled the waiter, who was conversing with a woman dining alone across the aisle, several tables back. That's the other woman. Dolchak, Ellery thought. Ellery had just entered the sleeper when he heard the muffled explosion. Gunshot! He instinctively quickened his pace as he proceeded down the corridor, between the roomettes, headed toward the double bedrooms at the rear of the car. The train lurched, Ellery lost his balance and slammed against the corridor wall. As he regained his footing, he heard a commotion ahead of him. Ellery rounded the corner that separated the roomettes from the bedrooms and froze in his tracks.
In front of him, kneeling on the ground, was the inspector, bending over someone sprawled out of bedroom C, partially into the hallway, and there was blood. Ellery approached his father and looked down, aghast. The inspector was cradling J.J. McHugh in his arms.
"He's been shot!"
the inspector cried, looking up at Ellery.
"Dear God, he's been shot!"
Ellery, dazed, noted that his father was crying, and then realized that he was beginning to as well. He knelt and placed his left hand on his father's shoulder.
"I was coming down the corridor when I heard a shot,"
the inspector stammered.
"It came from inside."
And he gestured up to the door to bedroom C.
"The door was locked, and I was going to ram it, but then it flew open, and J.J. fell out into the corridor. I caught him as he fell. He looked right into my eyes, Ellery, tried to say something, and then he was just gone."
As he had so often, Ellery pulled himself back from the precipice of despair and forced his mind to focus. "Dad, what did he say?"
"Ellery, give it a rest. It doesn't matter. It won't help. He's gone."
The inspector looked up at his son and realized that Ellery was still waiting for an answer.
"He told me," the inspector sighed, "how much he missed his sister, how sweet she was, and then he just closed his eyes, that's all."
The old man pulled a handkerchief from his trousers and wiped his own eyes. Ellery pinched his upper nostrils, at the same time wiping away his own tears, and took a deep breath. "This could be unraveled," Ellery thought. "Focus," he told himself again. Ellery looked up over J.J.'s body and into bedroom C in front of him. Luggage lay open on the couch, contents strewn throughout the bedroom. Ellery stood and looked down the corridor leading back to the diner. The attendant was now standing behind them, and behind the attendant, a burly man, whom Ellery did not recognize, was rushing toward them. Fumbling, the man produced a wallet as he approached and flipped it open to display a badge.
"Detective Dan Fontaine, Amtrak Police. What's happened here?"
The attendant fell back as Fontaine approached bedroom C. Ellery reached down, helping the inspector to his feet. The two of them stood back so Fontaine could better view the body on the floor.
"Our friend," the inspector said in a whisper. "Our friend. He's been shot. I think he's dead."
Fontaine, seemingly frozen in place, stared down at J.J., lying prone across the corridor. As they watched, J.J. coughed, and a trickle of blood flowed out of his mouth onto the carpeting. Ellery and the inspector gasped in unison as Fontaine turned to the attendant standing behind him.
"Check the manifest to see if there's a doctor on board, and secure this car. Don't let anyone in without my permission."
The attendant, wide-eyed, turned on his heels and trotted back down the corridor. Some minutes later, after J.J. McHugh had been carefully moved to the dining car, Fontaine returned.
"Your friend's in pretty bad shape. There's a Chicago doctor on board who's looking after him as best he can until we get to the next station and can transfer him to a hospital."
Having said this, Fontaine crossed his arms, stood silently staring, perhaps accusingly, at Ellery and the inspector. It was Ellery who broke the silence.
"Detective, we don't know what happened here. We just finished dinner with our friend, Judge J.J. McHugh. My father found him here after he had been shot. I don't want to intrude on what you need to do, but there's someone out there who did this, and who likely still has a gun."
"Wait a minute," Fontaine said. "First of all, who are you and the old man?"
"My name is Ellery Queen. I'm a writer, and this is my father, Richard Queen, retired inspector with the New York City Police Department."
The inspector fumbled for his credentials, proudly carried, though now stamped retired, and handed them to Fontaine. Fontaine's eyes narrowed, and he grudgingly nodded.
"All right,"
he said, and turned toward the attendant, who had returned and again stood silently behind them.
"Could you go back and watch the door to the car? Make sure that it stays sealed and that no one else comes back this way from the diner."
The attendant nodded and headed back past the roomettes toward the other end of the car.
"I'll assume for now that neither of you gents were involved in this," but Ellery cut him off.
"Detective, my father preceded me down the hall to this car. We are sharing bedroom B. I followed my father here after settling our bill in the diner. When I came back through the car, I heard a gunshot. I got here as fast as I could and passed no one else along the way. My father was here first, and our friend had already been shot. He fell out of the bedroom, which had been locked, into the corridor. This is the last car in the train. I presume that there's no way to exit from the rear end of the car?"
"Nope. The car door at the end is always locked from the outside."
"Dad, you saw no one else on the way back through the train?"
The inspector shook his head.
"Not when I came through this car, son."
"And no one else was in the bedroom when J.J. fell into the hall?" The inspector shook his head.
"And no one passed me as I approached. That means," said Ellery, that since neither Dad nor I encountered anyone when we came into the car, whoever did this should still be in front of us, between us and the end of the car. The three men stared down the short distance remaining in the corridor. Dad, you and I are in bedroom B, said Ellery. The car is 10 roomettes, but they're behind us. There are 5 bedrooms, but the only ones between us and the end of the car are bedroom B, which is ours, and bedroom A. If the door at the end of the car is secured, then the killer should still be in one of those 2 bedrooms. All 3 men raised their eyes toward the end of the car.
Wait here,
Fontaine muttered, drawing his gun. He proceeded down the hall. Minutes later, he was back.
Both rooms are empty,
he said, scratching his head. The door to bedroom C was locked when you heard the shot, right, Dad? The inspector nodded.
I tried to open it, but couldn't. Then the lock clicked from the inside, opened, and J.J. tumbled out under the floor. And the door can only be locked from the inside. Bedrooms on the train don't have keyholes, just sliding locks on the inside of the door, said Fontaine, stroking his chin.
So, mused Ellery, J.J. was locked in the room when he was shot, and after he was shot, he managed to open the door from the inside and fell out toward the corridor, leaving an empty and previously locked room behind. This time the inspector and Fontaine nodded together in unison.
But what happened to whoever did this? Any chance your friend shot himself? Fontaine asked.
Impossible, Ellery responded. And besides, if that were the case, where's the gun? The 3 men gazed into the bedroom. Fontaine rose, stepped inside, and Ellery and the inspector watched as he quickly searched through the scattered clothing in the adjoining lavatory.
No gun here,
he said, as he moved back into the corridor. Ellery gazed down the corridor and then turned back to Fontaine. Was this bedroom assigned to J.J. McHugh?
Not likely, Fontaine responded. All of the clothes in there are women's duds, but let me check the manifest.
Fontaine trotted back down the car toward the diner. He returned several minutes later with a sheaf of papers in his left hand.
The attendant's having a rough time up there keeping folks out of this car, Fontaine grumbled. 2 women are particularly adamant that they want to come back and check the rooms.
Fontaine unfolded the papers in his left hand and scanned the list.
Bedroom C is assigned to a passenger named Mint. Mint!
The inspector stared into Ellery's eyes.
The woman who we had dinner with. But what was J.J. doing in her room?
Ellery raised an eyebrow, but then looked back toward Fontaine. Who was in the room behind us, bedroom D? He asked. Fontaine scanned the sheets of paper again.
Someone named Franny Doljak. That would be Mint's assistant,
the inspector muttered. She mentioned her during dinner. Detective, Ellery asked, can we keep this car sealed for a while longer? I need to talk through all of this with my father for a few minutes.
Well, I suppose so, Fontaine stammered uncertainly.
Ellery caught the inspector's eyes and nodded toward the bedroom door. The queens retreated in unison to their bedroom. The inspector sat down on the couch as Ellery closed the door to bedroom B before turning to face the inspector. His father was again overcome, dabbing tears from the corners of ancient eyes, then reaching for his handkerchief and snorting loudly into it. The old man looked up at his son.
This is horrible. How did this even happen?
Ellery leaned back, hands templed, and stared at the ceiling of the train for a long moment. Then he laid a hand on the old man's knee. Dad, tell me again precisely what J.J. said to you while he was still conscious, right after he was able to open the bedroom door. The old man scowled.
I don't see how that's important. He just said that he missed his sister and that she was important to him. The same sort of nostalgic stuff we heard back in the diner.
Dad, tell me his exact words.
He said he missed his sister, and then he said his sister was sweet, and then he sort of looked back over his shoulder toward the bedroom, and then he must have passed out. I thought he had died.
Dad, please, think about it. What were the actual words he used? Did he say he would miss Catherine? The old man thought for a moment, and then slowly shook his head.
No, he called her Red. He said he missed Red.
But, Dad, Ellery continued patiently, that's past tense. Are you sure he said he missed Red?
Well, no. The inspector cast an exasperated look at Ellery. He said, I miss Red, and that she was sweet.
He said that Red was sweet? The old man blinked and looked across the bedroom at his son. Then the exasperation slowly evaporated as the beginning of comprehension dawned. Richard Queen closed his eyes in thought, and when he opened them, years had slipped away. It was the inspector of yore who stared back at Ellery and answered,
"What he said, what he precisely said, was five words. He said, 'I misread,' and then he sort of looked up toward the ceiling, and as best I could remember, he mumbled, 'Sweet K,' and then he closed his eyes."
The inspector, despite himself, again blinked back tears. Ellery sat still for a moment, and then slowly looked toward the ceiling of the bedroom. His silver eyes focused and then widened. Ellery stood and lurched to the door.
"Detective Fontaine,"
he called to the Amtrak detective, who turned and looked back. "Can you tell me which car Mr. McHugh was assigned to?" Fontaine consulted his list, still clasped in his left hand.
"Car 0330 on the other side of the diner in the lounge."
Ellery held out his right hand, palm up, silencing Fontaine in mid-sentence.
"And," Ellery said, "he was in bedroom C, wasn't he?"
Fontaine looked perplexed.
"Yeah, he was. How did you know that?"
But Ellery had already retreated to the bedroom. He closed the door, sat down, folded his arms, and stared silently at his father. The old man stared back into Ellery's eyes.
"You just figured it out, didn't you? Come on, son, give!"
Ellery leaned back on the bedroom settee and began to speak. "So, what do we have? J.J. is shot in a bedroom that is not his. The door to the room is locked from the inside. When J.J. opens the door from the inside, the only way it can be easily opened when it is locked, he tumbles out into your arms, leaving behind a room that has been searched for something. The clothes are strewn everywhere, but that is otherwise empty. When each of us approach the bedroom, we encounter no one else in the car, so one could reasonably conclude that the attacker had to have fled in the other direction, toward the end of the car. But a search of the rest of the car, the bedrooms, including ours, between there and the end of the car, revealed no one. In sum, we have a locked room, a disappearing gunman, and a clue from the victim's own mouth." The inspector narrowed his eyes.
"I still don't see how what J.J. said to me ties into any of that. And how could it be a clue?"
Ellery stared at his father and then looked at the door to the bedroom. From there, his eyes moved across the room. The inspector's eyes followed Ellery's, and he frowned for a long moment. The old man looked back at his son, and then he had it. The inspector's face nodded with a visage of grim determination.
"If that's how it was done, we need to find that train detective pronto."
Ellery, equally grim, nodded in assent. In unison, father and son left the bedroom and headed back down the corridor toward the dining car and Detective Fontaine, who, with the help of the attendant, was blocking entry to the sleeper. Behind them, a group of agitated passengers in the vestibule between the sleeper and the diner shuffled about, peering over their shoulders into the car.
"We need to talk," Ellery said to Fontaine, and cocked his head back down the corridor.
The Amtrak detective looked perplexed, but he moved ahead of Ellery into the corridor. Instead of following Fontaine, Ellery turned to the attendant standing behind him and smiled.
"I think we can let these folks proceed back to their bedrooms," he said. "Thanks for all your help."
And Ellery extended his right hand. The attendant gripped Ellery's hand, and Ellery hung on, as the inspector slipped his own hand into the attendant's coat, extracting a gun from the shoulder holster under the attendant's left arm.
"Silly way to carry a gun," the inspector grumbled. "You can always see it under the coat, and it can only be accessed with a shooting hand."
Ellery continued to grasp the attendant's right hand as the inspector trained the barrel of the gun on the attendant. Ellery looked back at Fontaine, whose mouth was agape.
"What the—"
exclaimed Fontaine.
"I think you will find that the gun that my father just extracted has recently been fired, and that the bullet that shot Judge McHugh came from it, and it's probably time to radio the next station to let them know that they should have the local police meet the train so we can turn over a would-be murderer to them."
Hours later, as Ellery and the inspector sat in the bedroom, glumly watching the scenery roll by, there was a knock on the door. Ellery opened it, and Detective Fontaine entered the bedroom, closing the door behind himself. The detective slouched into the chair opposite the settee.
"I'd like to know that your friend was transferred to the hospital at our last stop at La Junta. They radioed us to say he's in pretty bad shape, but that he's stable."
At this, Ellery brightened somewhat, and the inspector exhaled an audible sigh of relief.
"We also turned the car attendant over to the police and sorted out all of the charging papers. Turned out he was a new hire, and with a previous record for armed robbery and assault.
So all of that and the arrest rigmarole is behind us. But he wouldn't say a word, though, and I'm still at a loss to explain what he was after that was so danged important that he ransacked that bedroom in the first place and then tried to kill your friend.
What he was after, Ellery replied, was a diamond necklace, reportedly worth several million dollars. And I think a little checking will reveal that the ladies traveling in bedroom C and D are, in fact, the actress Joan Fairchild and her assistant. According to the newspapers, Fairchild is headed to Los Angeles for an awards show, and as the news story also notes, she's expected to arrive with her famous diamonds intact. The attendant figured out all of this the way we did, from the newspapers, and he figured the necklace must be in Fairchild's bedroom. If he had been successful in his haul, he could have ditched the train at the next stop and been set for life. Our unfortunate friend J.J. stumbled in on him in the middle of his search.
But—and the detective hesitated— A lot of this still doesn't make any sense. The guy only had the gun on him when we apprehended him. No necklace. And that lady, Mint, from bedroom C, swears that nothing was missing from her bedroom or from her assistants, even though her room had been ransacked. So where's the necklace? And how did the attendant end up getting out of the bedroom without either of you gents seeing him? And for that matter, what was your friend McHugh doing in the bedroom in the first place?
Ellery set aside the manuscript he unsuccessfully had been attempting to edit, and the inspector folded the newspaper he had been mostly ignoring. The two queens looked at each other.
"Do you want to start, Ellery?" asked the old man.
"Sure, Dad." Ellery turned toward Fontaine. "Let's address your questions in reverse order. When Judge McHugh, already shot, opened the door of bedroom C and fell into my father's arms, our friend told Dad two things before he lost consciousness. What Dad heard him say was, 'I misread Sweet K.' Judge McHugh's sister, Catherine, who recently died, was known by several names, as J.J. remarked when we ate dinner with him in the diner. Among those names were Red and K. Having just heard the judge lamenting the loss of his sister, it was only natural for Dad to interpret J.J.'s words, not as relevant to what had happened to him, but rather as a sorrowful reference to his sister. But that's not what J.J. was trying to say. The four words he actually uttered tell us everything." Fontaine interjected.
"Don't you mean five words?"
"No," Ellery replied. "It was four words. Stay with me on this. First, J.J. was not saying that he would misread. He was saying that he misread. He had left the diner in the wrong direction, then misread the number of his car and ended up opening the door not of his bedroom, bedroom C in car 0330, but Sandy Mint's bedroom, bedroom C in car 0331. J.J. was telling us first why he was there. Since Dad interpreted the first part of J.J.'s statement as a reference to his sister, it was only natural that he also interpreted the second part of the statement the same way. But since we know that the first thing J.J. was telling us did not involve his sister, that requires us to re-examine the second part of the statement as well. Do you want to jump in here, Dad?" The inspector nodded.
"What J.J. was trying to tell me," the inspector began, "was who the attacker was and how he made his escape. And J.J. did that as succinctly as possible. A number of the bedrooms in this car, including bedroom C, can be booked singly or," the inspector paused, "they can be booked as bedroom suites. When that occurs, the wall between the two bedrooms is opened and folded back, and to accomplish this, the wall is unlocked with a key. The attendant was surprised by J.J. as he ransacked bedroom C. J.J. must have confronted him, and for whatever unfortunate reason, the confrontation escalated and the attendant shot J.J. Fearing that the sound of the shot would draw immediate attention, the attendant then locked the door to bedroom C from the inside, opened the wall between it and bedroom D next door, and he then slipped into that bedroom and closed the wall behind him, leaving bedroom C empty except for our wounded friend and locked from the inside. Doubtless, the attendant did not realize that J.J. was still alive, had seen all of this, and had the strength to open the locked door and fall into the corridor. The attendant, next door, waited until Ellery and I had arrived and were consumed by the tragedy. At that point, we were outside bedroom C, trying to do what we could for J.J. while we were facing toward the rear of the train. The attendant simply slipped out of bedroom D behind us, where we saw him when you came down the corridor. And all of this was accomplished by the use of the key that unlocks the wall between the two bedrooms, a key that J.J. referred to, for lack of a better term, as a sweet key, which I mistakenly heard as Sweet K. So what J.J. in fact told me was quite concise. First, he said he was in Mint's room because he misread the car number. And second, his attacker was someone who possessed an escape using a sweet key. Who would have such a key? Well, the Amtrak employee whose duty it would be to unlock and fold back the bedroom wall when a suite of rooms is booked. And that person is the car attendant.
Which brings us, Ellery interjected, to that pesky and missing necklace. Bedroom C is occupied by the lady who joined Dad and me, and poor J.J., for dinner, Sandy Mint. There is no Joan Fairchild listed as a passenger in the train. So, if the owner of that valuable necklace is, indeed, on board, she's traveling under an assumed name. Miss Mint, with all of that silk and sable, certainly fits the part. Indeed, Dad told me after dinner that he suspected, based on news stories, that she is, in fact, Joan Fairchild. The attendant must have reached the same conclusion, so it was her bedroom, bedroom C, that he searched. But as we know, no necklace was found in bedroom C, either by the attendant or by you when you searched it. And that does not surprise me at all. Detective Fontaine stared at Ellery incredulously. Ellery held up his right hand, palm toward the detective, and continued, "Personally, I would bet that necklace isn't even on this train. It would make a lot more sense to ship something that valuable via special courier, but it never would have been in bedroom C in any event. Even before all of this mess began unfolding, I never thought for a moment that it was Joan Fairchild who joined us for dinner. Fairchild is notoriously insecure with crowds. She's been a virtual recluse for years. Does that sound like the conversationalist with whom we dined? The lady who easily joined a group of three strangers for dinner? That's a pretty thin reed to hang any conclusion on," Fontaine muttered. "Almost everyone on an Amtrak train dines with strangers." "And almost is the operative word," Ellery continued. "By contrast, the other woman, the traveling companion to Miss Mint, the one dressed in those conservative tweeds who Sandy Mint identified as her secretary, she did dine alone at a table across the aisle from us. And you were right about strangers and Amtrak diners, Detective Fontaine. How many times have you seen someone dine alone in a dining car? The answer is virtually never. The lady at that table, who I observed in conversation with the head waiter, would have had to have made special arrangements with the dining staff to secure a table that would not be shared as other passengers entered the car. And while even that indication of reclusiveness might not be enough to tip the scale, we know for a virtual certainty that it was that woman, not the woman with whom we dined, who is actually Joan Fairchild." "And how do we know that?" Fontaine asked. "From her name," replied Ellery. "Detective, do you still have the trade manifest with you?" Fontaine reached into his pocket and handed the folded paper to Ellery, who opened it and pointed to a name. "Franny Doljak." Ellery paused and then smiled. "It's spelled FRANNIEDOLJACH, and that's an anagram for Joan Fairchild." The necklace the attendant was intent on, search for which ultimately led to the shooting of our friend, was not in bedroom C. It probably isn't even on the train. But if it is on the train, it's in bedroom D, her bedroom, the bedroom that the attendant escaped through but that he had never thought to search. And, by the way, there is yet one more reason that we can conclude that the lady with whom we dined is not, in fact, the owner of those diamonds. The inspector, who knew his son well, was smiling, having already figured out where all of this was headed. But Fontaine's countenance conveyed that he was still in the dark. "Okay," the detective said, shaking his head. "And what would that be?" Ellery winked at his dad and smiled at the detective. All of the arrangements concerning those two women were acts of misdirection, aimed at protecting the identity of the real Joan Fairchild from prying public eyes. If the question even presented itself, we were supposed to suspect the expensively dressed lady with whom we dined was the famous and reclusive Joan Fairchild. The physical similarity between the two women, the fact that Joan Fairchild hasn't been seen or photographed in decades, the difference in the clothing of the two women, all of these were misdirections designed to let the real Fairchild fly under our radar alone and unrecognized, even by suspicious eyes. But in several ways, the ruse was too clever by half. First, Fairchild used an assumed identity that was, as we know, an anagram of her real name. But beyond that, the other reason that we know that the lady with whom we dined, the lady who in fact occupied bedroom C, was not Fairchild, is that she used the name Sandy Mint. Ellery again pointed to the manifest. S-A-N-D-Y-M-I-N-T. And that is also an anagram for my stand-in. Later, alone again in their bedroom, the inspector, who had been lost in thought for some time, turned away from the window and looked across the room at his son.
"I'm so relieved that J.J. is still with us, and I'm sorry that earlier I kept blubbering like a baby."
Ellery shook his head. "I've always subscribed to Washington Irving's view that tears are not a sign of weakness, but of power. We, you and I, have spent our lives pursuing death and unmasking its accomplices. The finality of it all can become unbearable."
"True enough," the inspector muttered.
You only die once. Yet another four words, Ellery mused. He was silent for a few moments, but then smiled and continued. Still, it can also be said that in another sense, we each die twice. Once when we breathe our last, but not finally, until the day when our names are last spoken. I'm glad we're taking this trip, Dad. Me too, Ellery.
Four Words is copyrighted by Dale C. Andrews. The Ellery Queen characters are copyrighted by the Frederick Denae and Manfred B. Lee Literary Property Trusts and are used in this story and its podcast by written permission. Music for the podcast was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing and editing for the podcast were done by Ray Purdom and Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at ellerycueenmysterymagazine.com.